Assalamu alaikum and good evening. Welcome to the third of our major presentations. The first two have given us a clear sense of the role and profile of the Muslims in Europe as it's developing and as we hope to see it develop an impact on Europe in the future. This evening, Hajj Abdulhaq, in his presentation, will focus now on the historical condition of Europe spiritually and in its relationship to God, and that will enable us to complete the picture as far as our examination of the European context is concerned. So, welcome and make the most of the death and rebirth of God in the European tradition. Hajj Abdulhaq Buley.
وصلى الله على سيدنا ومولانا محمد وآله وصحبه أجمعين. So this talk, as you've heard, is entitled The Death and Rebirth of God in the European Tradition. Human history has, from the earliest times, been permeated by an authentic spiritual tradition which has taken on various forms at various times. It has always involved, in one way or another, the acceptance and worship of God. Not, it must be said, the distant, capricious deity of misinterpreted scripture, but reality itself, that absolute singularity which is the source of all existence and on which everything is totally and continually dependent for its being, but which is itself beyond need of anything else. It is the possibility of conscious acknowledgement of this divine unity that sets apart the human being from all other creatures, and the unitary knowledge it entails is at once the core of all divine revelation and the highest goal of human consciousness. All the various great world religions are historical manifestations of this primordial natural religion, which has demonstrably been the central focus of human existence from the beginning of human history. This core religion involves inwardly the unique human capacity for not conscious knowledge of God and is reflected outwardly in the natural behavioral outline of a human being living in harmony with the laws governing the universe. It is what all the great traditional knowledge systems of mankind have always been based on. Behind all of them is the acceptance that human beings live in a universe created by one divine power, surrounded by many unseen dimensions or angelic realms. That our existence on this earth is a short-lived affair whose true significance lies in the fact that it is the realm of action, the result of which will become apparent in a further dimension of reality we will encounter when we die. And that divine guidance has come to tell us about all these things and to teach us how to live our lives in accordance with them. This, in brief, was the basic view of existence held by almost every human community from the beginning of human history down to the present age, and is the understanding of existence which lies at the core of all the true religious and philosophical traditions. Until the modern age, it has always been at once the starting point and the goal of human knowledge. It is abundantly clear that this is no longer the case, that human beings have been almost cut off completely from access to this clear understanding of existence. It is quite clear that up to a certain point in European history, these basic realities, which I have mentioned, remained unquestioned givens. In the European context, the traditional view was, for instance, clearly expounded in the 13th century by Thomas Aquinas. According to Aquinas, all things proceed from God, and God is not only the ground of their being, but also the supreme good with which all seek to be reunited. God created the world in order that he might know himself more completely. God not only created, but continuously sustains the world and governs it both directly by the eternal laws and indirectly through angelic forces. To all creatures, he has given a nature or form in virtue of which they are necessitated both to be what they are and to seek that which is proper for them. Man is different from other creatures in that only he can aspire to know God, and in this lies his only fulfillment, but he can either choose or deny this glorious possibility. Man is by his very nature oriented towards the supernatural world. He was created for knowledge of God. This was basically how everyone understood the world they lived in and their place in it. Then along came Bacon. It is not that Francis Bacon single-handedly changed the way that people viewed existence. However, every intellectual movement has those who epitomize and express it clearly, and Francis Bacon definitely did this in respect of that peculiar and significant change in human perspective which took place at the time of what is known historically as the Renaissance. Before this time, before the Renaissance, the measure of truth of any proposition had lain in whether or not it accorded with datum supplied by divine authority. From this time on, the measure of truth was whether a proposition accorded with human reason. Before the Renaissance, men were not so much concerned with things in themselves and their individual makeup and behavior, but rather with how they were connected with total being. At the Renaissance, men began to wish for a new life orientation, and this involved a hitherto unthought of analysis of and control over things. As Bacon said, those who determine not to conjecture and guess, but to find out and know, not to invent fables and romances of worlds, but to look into and dissect the nature of this real world, must consult only things themselves. Admirable sentiments, you might say, but wait and see what their implications are. The real world, for pre-Renaissance man, had been the realm of divine power. Bacon's real world is the limited realm of sense perception. For Bacon and those who followed, the scope of the idea of truth became increasingly confined to mean scientific truth. Scientific truth gradually became the only genuine truth. Metaphysical truth, which can sometimes appear to be at odds with a limited scientific understanding, became increasingly pushed to one side and eventually ignored. Existence, which had been considered as one thing, as a totality with interpenetrating spiritual and material dimensions, became split into two. Now there was the truth of religion and the truth of science in two quite separate domains. And it is clear that Bacon's desire to separate religious truth and scientific truth was in the interests of science and not of religion. He wished to keep science pure from religion. All of this is encapsulated in Bacon's famous dictum, which is at the same time both the denial of true belief in God and also the source of all scientific truth. He said, "God works in nature only by secondary causes." This basic fallacy, metaphysically untrue and yet deceptively verifiable empirically, became the foundation stone of the scientific worldview. There was a general transference of interest from metaphysics to physics, from the contemplation of being to the observation and analysis of physical phenomena. Empirical science, under the name of natural philosophy, claimed to replace theology as the supreme form of knowledge. As M. Maritain says in his book about Thomas Aquinas, what really happened at the Renaissance was that the mathematical science of the world of sense perception and its phenomena took precedence over metaphysics, and the human mind began to profess independence of God and being. Instead of being satisfied with the kind of truth which was consistent with divinely revealed teaching, men began to desire the kind which would enable them to measure, to weigh, and to control the things around them. They desired, in Bacon's words, to extend more widely the limits of the power and greatness of man. The existence of the divine gradually receded further and further into the inconceivable and became, in practical terms, irrelevant as the frontiers of natural causation were pushed back until finally the idea of God became, in the scientific worldview, nothing more than a scientific hypothesis almost identifiable with absolute space. Revealed knowledge began to appear, if not superfluous, at least definitely secondary, and often highly inconvenient. While scientific knowledge, which had been considered merely a supplement to revelation, became the standard against which revelation should be tested. And if the scientific fact apparently contradicted the revealed text, revelation was rejected in favor of science. With the French philosopher Descartes, Bacon split between religion and science, between the spiritual and the material worlds, became hardened and widened. Descartes based his position on the dualism of subject-object, spirit-matter. Man is likewise split into two as mind and body, although exactly how the two are connected is never made completely clear. Man, according to Descartes, is a thinking mind stuck in a material body looking out onto an alien world. Descartes is rightly known as the father of modern philosophy, since nearly all thinkers since him have taken as their starting points the view of existence formulated by him. The other celebrated achievement of Descartes was his famous scientific method, which dovetailed in with and helped to form the newly emerging scientific view of existence. The old way had been to basically take things on trust as manifestations of divine creative power. But Descartes' starting point is complete skepticism regarding both received opinions and beliefs and also sense data. Nothing is to be considered true until it has been conclusively proved to the observer to be so. He himself expresses it thus: "Never to accept anything for true which I did not clearly know to be such, to comprise nothing more in my judgment than what was presented to my mind so clearly and distinctly as to exclude all ground of doubt." Thus he made his own reason, and by extension human reason in general, the ultimate arbiter of what is true or not true. What Descartes left us with is a picture of the human being as a mind enclosed in a body, looking out as subject-observer onto an objective, separate world surrounding him, which had to be brought under control and made to serve him. He says in his book, Discourse on Method, "I perceived it to be possible to arrive at a knowledge highly useful in life, to discover a practical by means of which, knowing the force and action of fire, water, the stars, the heavens, and all other bodies that surround us, we might also apply them in the same way to all the uses to which they are adopted, and thus render ourselves the lords and possessors of nature." And not only was man separate from the material world outside himself, it was basically not to be trusted, and all incoming data had to be subjected to intense scrutiny before it could be admitted as trustworthy and true. He was indeed the philosopher of the new age of science, and at the same time undermined by his skepticism the inherent sense of a benevolent providence that had existed up until that time. So from a situation where the spiritual was given precedence over the material, we moved with Bacon to a situation where pride of place was given to the material and the spiritual took on a background role. With Descartes, the spiritual side of existence was divorced from the material and banished to the outer reaches of the universe. It was now but a short step to the logical conclusion, the final stage in the process, which was to do away with the spiritual altogether. This position found expression in the work of the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes. In his own words, "This universe, that is, the whole mass of things that are, is corporal, that is to say, body, and hath the dimensions of magnitude, namely length, breadth, and depth. Also every part of the body is likewise body, and hath the like dimensions, and consequently every part of the universe is body, and that which is not body is not part of the universe. And because the universe is all, that which is no part of it is nothing, and consequently nowhere." What Hobbes is saying is that all that is real is material existence, and anything other than material existence is not real. By saying this, Hobbes was simply giving expression to what had in fact already become the dominant view of existence, which was that only that was true which could be verified empirically. The limits of human sense perception had in fact become the limits of existence. If you couldn't weigh it, or measure it, or time it, or in some other way control it, it was not real. This meant that already by Hobbes' time, mechanico-materialism was accepted as an exhaustive account of reality. This view of existence has, of course, profound implications for the way the human being was perceived. From being a prisoner inside a body, man was now totally identified with that body. Hobbes writes, "When we say that a man is a living body, we mean not that the man is one thing, the living body another, and the is, or being, a third, but that man and the living body is the same thing." With Hobbes, any spiritual dimension of existence, whether in man or the universe, microcosm or macrocosm, was denied altogether. The world of the spirit had ceased to exist. This also had profound social and political implications for human communities. In the old view, absolute authority was synonymous with God. In the new view, the embodiment of authority on the earth achieved absolute status. The state became the absolute authority. Government, the state apparatus, the laws of the land, became the absolute arbiters of human behavior. Hobbes decries the possibility of spiritual influences and other such things in his words, and other such things that serve to lessen the dependence of subjects on the sovereign power of their country. So that rather than being servants of a benevolent universal order, the human being is reduced to being identified as the subject of a limited temporal authority dictated by the place he lives and to which he owes absolute allegiance. Alongside this philosophical unfolding, hand in glove with it, inseparable from it, we find its practical expression in the outward world at the hands of those natural philosophers who chose practical research and experimentation and scientific theory as the field of their endeavor. They started as astronomers, turned into physicists, and eventually into engineers. As the application of the new philosophy became increasingly devoted to control and domination of the natural order. Again, the whole process is embodied in a number of landmark figures who epitomize it and epitomize their time, namely Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton. These are the names that stand out in the scientific pantheon. With his work, The Revolutions of the Celestial Spheres, the Polish astronomer Copernicus single-handedly tore apart the traditional view of the universe. Men had always seen the earth on which they lived as the stationary center of physical existence, around which the sun, moon, the planets, and galaxies revolved in their various orbits. The Copernican system depicted the Earth as merely one of several planets orbiting the Sun and made this solar system one among countless other similar systems dotted about in an unimaginably vast universe. Mankind, from being central to the life of the universe, became an insignificant species living somewhere undefined in limitless space. This theory of Copernicus, based in fact on limited observation, and which he himself was reluctant to publish in his own lifetime, is the foundation stone of all those scientific advances that have flowed thick and fast from that moment on. He holds the same position in the scientific line as Bacon did in the philosophic one, in that he opened up the way for everything which followed. The Italian Galileo took up where Copernicus left off. His invention of the telescope enabled him to effectively and devastatingly demonstrate the facticity of Copernicus's theories. And to disprove many of the unfortunate medieval Christian excursions into the world of natural science. For instance, by his visual evidence of the cratered surface of the moon, he demolished the theory of perfect spheres, which had been central to the scholastic view of the physical universe, showing beyond doubt that the physical universe was different from what had been posited by metaphysical speculation. In spite of being hounded out by the ecclesiastical authorities for his faith-shattering disclosures, he nevertheless ensured by them the demise of the old order. However, his possibly even more significant contribution to the scientification of the world was in the field of mechanics. By dropping things off the Leaning Tower of Pisa and watching a chandelier swing to and fro in a church, if the stories are true, he hit upon ideas that were eventually to prove truly earth-shattering. For his work on the laws of motion and momentum and his discoveries in the field of mechanics were to form the groundwork on which almost all the subsequent developments were based. To him also can be attributed the modern form of the scientific experiment, with its data collection and subsequent analysis. Strangely enough, there is a correlation between Galileo and the second of my philosophers, Descartes. By his work in mathematics and physics, Galileo brought together the heavens and the earth, which had previously been considered totally independent spheres of existence. He joined together what had been previously separated. As we already noted, Descartes separated body and spirit, thereby separating what had previously been considered joined together. However, the joining of Galileo and the separating of Descartes had in fact the same result, the distancing of the human being from the realm of spirit and therefore from the divine. The third in our triad of scientist-philosophers, practical exponents of the new philosophy, is the Englishman Isaac Newton, to whom is attributed the astounding discovery that if you sit under a tree in an orchard in early autumn, you are quite likely to be hit on the head by a falling apple. Whether or not it was, as legend would have it, this event which led up to it, what is certain is that taking over where Galileo and another astronomer Kepler had left off, Newton formulated what he called the law of universal gravitation and the three fundamental laws of mechanics, the incalculable advancement of scientific knowledge, even if to the eventual detriment of the natural and human environments. His work on light and optics and his discovery of calculus, which is an indispensable tool in many later discoveries, were without doubt significant. But it is his magnum opus, Principia Mathematica, in which he formulated the laws of mechanics and gravity, which proved to be the fundamental work for the whole of modern science. There are few people who have so changed people's perception of the universe they live in. After Newton, mystery disappeared from the universe. Everything was now self-explanatory in terms of mutually dependent, internally self-consistent, interactive forces, needing no extra universal stimulus. He fulfilled the same role in the scientific domain that Hobbes did in the philosophic. After Newton, there was no longer any need for God. Everything was perfectly explicable without positing divine intervention. to all practical purposes, God had been expelled from the universe. Now, what, it might be asked, has all this stuff about philosopher-scientists and scientist-philosophers of the 16th and 17th centuries got to do with ordinary people today? The answer is, unfortunately, almost everything. These men I have talked of expounded and exemplified a way of looking at existence which rapidly disseminated itself through every strata of human society and into every sphere of human activity. Before then, human beings had lived at the center of the universe with the sun and moon and stars revolving around them, above which were the celestial spheres of angelic activity, all encompassed by the throne of God, whose unseen hand moved and directed the whole affair. After them, people lived on an insignificant mineral mass, a mere part of a minor planetary system, one of countless others lost in the unimaginable vastness of limitless space. The former perspective, metaphysically true, but empirically inaccurate, the latter, empirically true, but spiritually and psychologically disastrous. Professor E. Burt, writing about what had happened, says, "It was of the greatest consequence for succeeding thought that now the great Newton's authority was squarely behind that view of the cosmos which saw in man a puny, irrelevant spectator, in as far as a being wholly imprisoned in a dark room can be called such, of the vast mathematical system whose regular motions, according to mechanical principles, constituted the world of nature. The world that people had thought themselves living in, a world rich with colour and sound, a world of purposive harmony and creative ideals, no longer existed except in imagination. The real world outside was a hard, cold, colourless, silent and dead world, a world of quantity, a world of mathematically computable motions in mechanical regularity. In Newton, the Cartesian metaphysics finally overthrew Aristotle and became the predominant worldview of modern times. It was as if an impenetrable barrier had been erected between the spiritual and the material. Belief in God, which had been an inextricable part, a given of the human situation, became at best an optional extra, and increasingly frequently not an option at all. God became a hypothesis, an immaterial abstraction, a philosophical postulate dependent upon argumentation for his very existence. And because of the way scientists explained away natural phenomena, making them merely a matter of analysis and calculation, the traditional God-centered view of existence became to all intents and purposes completely inaccessible. Human beings, as the scientific worldview inexorably imposed itself and permeated human consciousness, became cut off from knowledge of the divine. Human consciousness became confined within the limits of the material universe. There were, of course, exceptions, but for the overwhelming majority of people, the scientific worldview proved an insuperable obstacle between themselves and a true view of existence. Beginning in the 16th century and becoming firmly established, as we have seen in the 17th, the new philosophy swept all before it throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. Its practical application in science and technology, the ever-increasing flood of inventions and discoveries, banished every doubt and secured undreamed-of wealth and political domination from those who controlled them. The juggernaut proved unstoppable, scooping up or crushing everything in its path. Nothing was able to stand in its way. To all intents and purposes, the divine had been expelled from human consciousness. How beautifully, though despairingly, Matthew Arnold expresses what happened in his poem Dover Beach. He said, "The sea of faith was once too at the full round the earth's shore, and round the earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind, down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world." And the tide has gone a long way further out since then. From the point of view of scientific materialism, God had died. Then, in a most surprising turnabout, the possibility of divine existence re-emerged from right within the scientific bastion which had been responsible for its demise. As the 20th century got underway, cracks started to appear in the previously unbreachable edifice of mechanistic science. Not inflicted from outside, there was nothing left for the strength to do it, but from within. That very matter, the solid substance upon which the whole edifice rested and of which it was supposedly built, was suddenly discovered to be quite other than had been supposed. That very spirit of inquiry and experimentation, which had been the energy behind the new philosophy and had brought it into being, was now to prove its undoing. Rutherford and Bohr showed conclusively that the atom, the supposedly basic building block of existence, was mostly empty space. Max Planck showed that some of the basic premises of classical physics were mistaken. The proud edifice of classical physics was cracking everywhere, threatening to crash down on its practitioners. When Werner Heisenberg formulated his famous uncertainty principle, the cat was really among the pigeons. Rutherford's atomic model, with its minute particles coursing through empty space, had given a severe jolt to the classical concept of solid matter. Its transformation into a diffuse wave pattern had made things even worse. These worries, however, were completely eclipsed by Heisenberg's uncertainty relation. Determinacy, the singular connection of cause and effect, was rightly regarded as the rock on which natural philosophy was built, and now with Heisenberg, this safe basis, this basic premise, had been taken away. This whole revolution in the understanding of the nature of matter is as important for our understanding of the nature of existence as were the discoveries of the 17th century. Matter, rather than being the lifeless substance posited by Newton, mechanistically determined by being acted on from outside, turns out at its very heart to be composed of energy itself. Rather than being inert and predictable, it is in fact highly dynamic and very mysterious. While the philosophical implications of all this have yet to make themselves generally felt in everyday life, they are certainly in evidence at the leading edge of every field of scientific inquiry. For the purpose of this talk, I will take just one example as an illustration, but the same applies in almost every other field of research. In 1965, after more than 10 years of clinical research into the way human beings experience pain, Professor Patrick Wall published his gate control theory, which has revolutionized understanding of this important area of medical knowledge. Before Wall's theory, there had been no previous model of pain since that proposed by Descartes in 1664, which had survived for 300 years curiously intact, in spite of its inapplicability to patients' actual experience of suffering. Such was the power of the dominant thinking. Descartes' theory, simply put, was that pain travelled as a straight-through pathway from the point of injury to the brain, where it was perceived by the mind, rather like a bell rope is pulled at the bottom of a tower and makes a bell ring in the belfry. Professor Wall, however, discovered many anomalies between this theory and people's actual experience of pain. And in the spirit of the fresh avenues of thought opened up by the new scientific revolution, came to see that the perceived sensation of pain could not in fact be considered separate from the perceiver. We came to the conclusion, he says of himself and his collaborator, Ronald Metzak, that Cartesian dualism really is a philosophical trap, and that in fact what you are thinking and what you are feeling are so intimately connected that it is not really useful to separate mind and body in this sense. They are really acting as a unity. The basic truths of 17th century science have one by one been knocked down and shown to be a completely inadequate way of describing a physical reality vastly more complex, subtle, and unified than had previously been supposed. Far from being the rigid barrier barring access to spiritual possibilities, a role it has been falsely playing for three centuries, matter turns out to be the very opposite. It is in fact a window onto, a gateway into, an access point for, a world which defies any definition in physical terms and which can only be explained in terms formerly reserved for spiritual realities. The atomic physicist Fritjof Capra has expressed this in a particularly lucid and eloquent way when he says, "When quantum mechanics, the theoretical foundation of atomic physics, was worked out in the 1920s, it became clear that even the subatomic particles were nothing like the solid objects of classical physics. At the subatomic level, the solid material of classical physics dissolve into wave-like patterns of probabilities. A careful analysis of the process of observation in atomic physics has shown that the subatomic particles have no meaning as isolated entities, but can only be understood as correlations between the preparation of an experiment and the subsequent measurement. This implies, however, that the Cartesian division between the world and I cannot be made while dealing with atomic matter. Quantum mechanics thus reveals a basic oneness in the universe. As we penetrate into matter, nature does not show us any isolated basic building blocks, but rather appears as a complicated web of relations between the various parts of the whole, and these relations always include the observer in an essential way. So this is where our scientists have ended up. But what about our philosophers? Philosophy no longer has the status it had at the beginning of the modern age, because as we've seen, the modern age has been largely devoted to quantity and pragmatic considerations, and so only those ideas that lead directly to practical results are really esteemed. However, some people have continued to think. And Bacon, Descartes, and Hobbes have had their successors. The philosophy that has emerged is, in most cases, a very specialized esoteric affair, highly involved with semantics and linguistics, with a very particular language that is quite inaccessible to the uninitiated. It has largely been trapped within a view of existence that never permits the philosopher to escape from his own ratiocination. However, there has at the same time been a line of thinkers who were never entirely happy with the worldview being propagated by Descartes and Newton. And these philosophers have been continually struggling to break free from the shackles of dualism and materialism. This line can be traced down through Leibniz, who was quite literally came into conflict with Newton, and Hegel to Nietzsche, and finally, in this century, to Martin Heidegger, who was significantly a great friend of the physicist Heisenberg. Just as the great physical breakthrough came with Heisenberg, the philosophical breakthrough came with Heidegger. There is no time, nor am I qualified, to give even a resume of Heidegger's conclusions. But suffice it to say that with Heidegger, man is no longer considered as a mind in a physical body looking out on a separate world, but rather as Dasein, literally being there, a complex fusion of past, present, and future and the world he lives in, only truly brought to life by the search for the meaning of being itself, which is what gives existence to himself as one being among others. Heidegger says about being itself, "Being is what is emptiest, and at the same time it is abundance, out of which all beings, known and experienced, or unknown and yet to be experienced, are endowed each with the essential form of its own individual being. Being is most universal, encountered in every being, and is therefore most common. It has lost every distinction or never possessed any. At the same time, being is most singular, whose uniqueness cannot be attained by any being whatsoever. Over and against every being that might stand out, there is always another just like it. That is another being, no matter how varied their forms may be. But being itself has no counterpart. Being reveals itself to us in a variety of oppositions that cannot be coincidental, since even a mere listing of them points to their inner connection. Being is both utterly void and most abundant, most universal and most unique, most intelligible and most resistant to every concept, most in use and yet to come, most reliable and most abyssal, most forgotten and most remembering, most said and most reticent. You would have to go a long way to find a clearer or more complete exposition of a unified view of existence than that contained in these few lines. What is clear from all these things, and from the position reached by scientists at the leading edge of scientific investigation in every field, is that the door to the divine is once again open. Scientific truth no longer stands in opposition to metaphysical truth, barring the way to a deeper understanding of the nature of existence. The history of being, to use Hegel's expression, has reached a point where the prevailing climate of opinion has made knowledge of the relationship between God and the rest of creation once more accessible to human consciousness in a real way. A path through the forest has been cleared, and the way is open, but the full implications of this quantum change in perspective have yet to filter down to the level of general human consciousness. This will not happen automatically, and this reborn knowledge of the divine will need to be dug out, ushered in, brought to light. The midwives in this process will inevitably be those people who have retained an unbroken connection to the ancient traditional knowledge of the divine, which was the starting point of this talk. It must first be said that Christianity has forfeited this role. The fact is that the inner fabric of Christendom, having been severely frayed by the storms of the Reformation, was then completely ripped apart by the onslaught of the new philosophy, and has capitulated and compromised at every turn ever since. I want to say here that I am not talking of Christian beliefs or personal piety. What I am referring to is Christianity as the spiritual, legal, and moral basis of European society. Christianity progressively lost its ability to impinge in any real way on society as a whole. And it is now obvious in so many ways, particularly in this country, that in social terms, Christianity has disintegrated beyond the possibility of restoration. That Christianity is demonstrably no longer capable of furnishing that clear guidance which is so necessary for there to be a spiritually healthy and just human situation. No, the mantle of conveying this knowledge has inevitably fallen squarely on the shoulders of Islam. Of all the traditional systems, only Islam has survived complete and intact into our own time, still able to provide unadulterated the true picture of existence in all its vastness and splendor. Only in Islam is it possible to find the necessary guidance to bring about the spiritual, intellectual, and social renewal which is so clearly vital at this time. Only Islam can provide the necessary spiritual, intellectual, and legal framework to enable the opportunities made available by the breakthrough in science and philosophy to bear fruit and be used for the benefit and fulfillment of all human beings. The other spiritual traditions have now been reduced to the status of archaeological fragments. They are incomplete or altered teachings intended for other peoples and former times. The philosophical tradition has worn itself out and become lost in details and abstractions. The scientific tradition is inhuman and appears bent on self-destruction. It is the final dispensation of divine guidance expressed in the Quran and demonstrated for us by the last of God's messengers, Muhammad, that is the key to the future. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. It shows us the form that the knowledge of God implicit in the emerging world view should take, how it should be expressed in each individual and society as a whole. What is meant here is not Islam as an historical phenomenon, nor Islam in any of its acquired cultural identities, which tend to give the impression that Islam is a more or less rigid structure that you somehow get hold of and apply to the situation you are in. To view it in this way is to fundamentally misunderstand the Islamic phenomenon. Islam is not a structure, it is a process. It is not a template that came down out of the sky to be picked up and used again and again like a second-hand suit of clothes, to be handed on from one generation to generation. It is an organic growth pattern for human society. What is needed now is a new growth of Islam, distinct from any discrete form that Islam has taken in the past. We have to bring out a new growth of Islam from the very texture of our own time, an expression of Islam that will embrace and encompass and absorb and transform the classical tradition of Greece and the European tradition I've been talking about, which has now reached to the point where it is once more potentially open to divine guidance. We cannot go back to the mainsprings of Islam, the book and Sunnah. This would suggest the Quran is an historical document, something from the distant past, and the Sunnah was like an ancient suit of armor. The Quran is the uncreated word of Allah originating outside space and time. We must rediscover its meaning in the present, reflect on them anew, seek out their light and energy, and make them our springboard for the re-establishment of Islam in this time. The Sunnah is the archetypal record of how human perfection in the person of the Prophet, may Allah bless him and grant him peace, turned divine guidance into a living reality, and how he and his companions, may Allah be pleased with all of them, transformed themselves and their situation. To follow the Sunnah, we must discover something of the qualities of the Prophet in ourselves, transform ourselves in the way his companions did, transform our situation as they did theirs. In other words, we must go forwards to the book and Sunnah, not back to them. The people of our time need Islam freshly cooked, not reheated. We must have the thing itself, not an imitation. We must recover the life pattern based on divine guidance which the Prophet, may Allah bless him and grant him peace, and his companions established for all future generations in Medina. Nothing else will do. This is certainly not a task for the faint-hearted. It will require a great courage, total commitment, and profound faith. What is needed is a new generation of Muslims, new men and women, ready and able to face the challenge of this new age, capable of transforming themselves and the society they live in, capable of breaking out of the enslaving enchantment of the modernist perspective with its illusory shadow show politics and real economic domination, capable of grasping the possibilities opened up by the emerging new world view, determined to re-establish Islam in all its simplicity and splendor. Only then will we see the rebirth, not of course of God himself, who is by definition the living who never dies, but of that knowledge of God, which is at once the purpose of human existence and the essential ingredient for the successful continuation of human society.